There you are. Well, I hope everybody is all right. And I hope you're beginning to get the feeling of this particular session. I always say this because I can never get over it. How it is that session seems to occur in no time at all, because nothing is going on. Nothing is happening at all. And therefore, no time is passing. I mean, this is what I feel like. And maybe you understand what I mean. Now, on the one hand, time is going by very swiftly, shockingly swiftly, disturbingly swiftly. And yet, at the same time, there isn't any time. We're sitting there eating breakfast, and we have always been sitting there eating breakfast. Do you know that feeling? And it's really true. You know, we are always sitting there eating breakfast. And when you see that, you no longer worry in quite the same way about what happens to your supposed life. You just can go on practicing being wholehearted. And you know that everything is okay. Now, I know that some of you here from the session are from the south of the border, the United States. And I know that even those of you who are not from the south, like others around the world, have been, it's been impossible not to pay attention to the truly astonishing American presidential election, which is always a spectacle. But this year, more than ever, it's been a fabulous, unbelievable, quite literally unbelievable spectacle. And we were all quite surprised by the result. And now there's a lot of uncertainty and confusion, really all over the world, about what's going to happen next. It's a very unstable moment. And some people are trying to normalize the situation. They're trying to imagine that actually, in reality, despite everything that was said and done in the past, it's just going to be another government, more or less as usual, possibly somewhat worse, possibly somewhat better, depending on your point of view, but really another government, not that different. It's going to be normal. Which is possible. It's also possible that it won't be normal at all. It will be abnormal. And already there's lots of discussion going on, maybe you're aware of it, and many, many kinds of actions happening to respond to abnormal situation that might happen. One thing I know about, there's a plan for a 1 million woman march on Washington the day after the inauguration, because I think that on a deeply psychic level, the results of the election were really hurtful and disturbing, in particular for women. I know because I hear this from the women in my life. So elections are political events, and we pay attention to them as political events, but they're also cultural events. And culture is not one-dimensional. It's very hard to know what is meant. What does a cultural event mean? What does it stand for? What does it mean to us? And lots of smart people are writing about this and talking about this. So does that sound go on all day long in the Zendo, every now and then? Is that, about every 30, 40 minutes or something like that?
Two or three times a day.
Only two or three times a day. Oh. Oh, that's good. I thought maybe once an hour on the hour. So what was I talking about there? Let's see. So many people are thinking about this election, and smart people, a lot of smart people writing about it. And nowadays, beyond the smart people, we also have statistics and data, right? So then we have all this data, which tells you, supposedly, which people voted which way, and why, and what it all means. So we have tons of information and opinions, but nobody really knows what it means, right? Who can know what it means? No doubt it means a million different things all at the same time. The course of any individual life, my life, your life, and even more so the course of our collective life together on the planet, has a surface level of events and known determinations, but also a depth level, a depth of feeling and flow that none of us ever see or understand. Why did this or that happen in your life, and what does it really mean? How come you had the parents that you had and not some other parents? How come you were so profoundly affected by that particular breakup? What was it about that that got you so deeply? How come you live where you live? Why don't you live somewhere else? How did that happen? There are reasons, right, for everything. Reasons that we think we know, and reasons that we don't know, that are very mysterious. And probably the mysterious reasons are the most important reasons, and we will never know. So it is with our collective destiny. Where are we all going? What is our fate? We really don't know. And yet, I think, deep down on this deeper, darker level, everybody's thinking about it. Everybody's thinking about the fate of humanity. And it's disturbing us all. And it's entering into our waking life and the life of our dreams. And there's some kind of a dread, I think, in the world. Some kind of a disturbing fear and confusion, as if we know we're reaching some kind of barrier or limit. It's just like we've been children on the planet Earth all these many generations. And all of a sudden, we've been shocked with the realization that someday we're going to die, and that we probably can't keep on going the way we've been going all this time. And now it's time to grow up. And we don't know what this means, and we don't know what to do. And I think this affects all of our lives, whether we think about this or not. And it affects our collective life. So when elections have crazy results, not only in the United States, but all over the world, thank goodness at the moment, not in Canada. And when crazy, violent stuff happens, we're shocked all over again, but really we shouldn't be surprised at all. This is what we do when we lose our bearings. Which is why living with ease in a crazy world is a more essential practice now than it ever has been. And I think we all need to imagine for ourselves, how do we live in troubled times? Because it looks to me like we're in troubled times. At least at the moment it appears to be that way. So we better think about this. And, you know, one forgets that there have been troubled times before. Some of you are old enough to remember what it was like in the 1960s. Not only around here, but all over the world. The assassinations, right? One after the other, of inspiring and important leaders. I mean, who could believe that in a short period of time, John Kennedy was killed, Robert Kennedy was killed, Martin Luther King was killed, Malcolm X was killed, among many others, in a very short period of time. It was shocking, horrifying. Every day, many thousands were killed in Vietnam. Bombs were dropped on villages every day. Forests were being wrapped in flames with napalm bombs being dropped on them. No young man was safe from the draft and the war. College students were shot dead on campuses by National Guard soldiers. There were American young insurgents on the streets robbing banks and taking hostages. It was really something. I'm glad that some of you don't remember this. This was really something. So stuff like this happens every now and then. It happened before, not only here, but elsewhere in different times throughout history. It happens. And when it happens, you have to ask yourself, how do you survive troubled times and what do you do? So I think as bodhisattvas, we take all of this quite seriously. We know that what we see is not the entirety of what's going on. There's more going on than we know, than we can see. And we also know that something absolutely trustworthy holds up the world. And that's why we don't freak out. But we're human beings. We're not ghosts or angels. So we're part of what this world is and must be. So we all have to do something. We have to take our place. Collectively, together, we tip the world this way or that way. So each of us does what we can. And we were talking about this yesterday. We don't know what to do, but we do what we can from where we are. And I've been, during the night of the election and ever since, writing and posting things about the election just because I want to take responsibility to do my part from where I'm sitting. So Sesshin is not the time for political analysis or political talk, but it is the time to think, what does our practice show us as a path forward in dark times? Because if our practice doesn't help us with that, then what's the point? There's a line in Shantideva that says something like, if you can do something about a bad situation, do it. Don't just moan and complain. And if there's nothing you can do about a bad situation, what good could it possibly do to moan and complain? True. But I would add to Shantideva's words that maybe there is a time when you just can't help it. You have to moan and complain. So at that time, moaning and complaining is your practice. You moan and complain. But it's a practice because you know what you're doing. You understand, here I am stupidly moaning and complaining and I can't help it. Here I am singing our sad human song. So you sing. And then when the song is over, you shut up and you go on with other practice activities. And all across America right now, people are registering their protests and deciding on various actions, all kinds of things to do in the face of this election and what it means for our global situation. Some mayors of American cities are saying, when you send the agents to come and collect the immigrants and deport them, we will not cooperate. Lawyers are all figuring out how to bring multiple suits to bear on the cockeyed business dealings of the president-elect, all of which are completely fuzzy and funny and subject to multiple suits. Lawyers are like scheming about how they're going to do this. Poor fellow won't have time to govern the country. He'll be too busy defending his business interests, which he feels are more important than other things. All kinds of people are standing up for one another. People are standing up for the most vulnerable and saying, we're going to stand with the vulnerable. We're going to be there. In the city of Oakland, near where I live, thousands of people surrounded Lake Merritt and held hands around the lake in support of what they call the Love Trumps Hate movement. Artists are planning all kinds of events all over the place. I've been communicating with poets in my local poetry community, organizing what they are calling sustained resistance, a series of events that will go on and on, celebrating art and creativity and calling attention to whatever bad political event is the current bad political event. My son, Noah Fisher, is an activist artist who has been working on this stuff long before the election cycle even began, even before Occupy Wall Street began. He was working on this stuff. And he views all his actions, protests, and interventions as art events, which means that they emphasize love and creativity and joy, not resentment, bitterness, and despair. So yes, there are many things to do. I think it's going to be so interesting to see the millions of events that many millions of people will be doing in resistance to bad politics. Much more is going to be going on in support of the good than would have been going on if the election had turned out differently. So whatever way we can participate in this, we will. But as Dharma practitioners, we have a special role, I think, not only as practitioners of Zen or Buddhism, but as spiritual practitioners of all sorts have a special role. Because when we human beings are full of fear and dread, it is very likely, as we've already seen, that some of us will do stupid things that will make matters worse. And we're sure of this because not only have we seen it externally, but we notice it in ourselves. We ourselves, right, in the face of difficulty, have done stupid things, making our own situations worse. So we know it happens. And that's why we're here, because practice shows us another way. We know how to pay attention to our fear and dread without having it destabilize us. We know that when we face what's difficult, we become stronger and more courageous. We find a spirit that is sustainable and kind. And we know that fear and hating simply don't bring good results. They only make more fear and hating. This is not like our theory. We've observed this in ourselves and in our own life, and we know it's true. So, when we participate in whatever we participate in, we bring the firm and loving spirit of our practice to share with others in those activities. Maybe not everybody will appreciate this point of view, but anyway, we are going to keep on offering the Bodhisattva spirit no matter what, because that's our job, and that's our role, and that's what we will do. And in order to do that, we're going to really have to be very, very strong with our practice. We're going to have to really concentrate and be serious about our practice. Some people might think that spiritual practice is a luxury, that in tough times, who has time for this meditation business? Some people might think that spiritual practice is a little bit fuzzy, a little soft, weak, not what's needed in drastic times. So I wouldn't argue with any of that. I'm sure there's some truth to it. But I also know for sure that in anything you do, underlying motivation, underlying attitude, understanding and emotion condition everything you do. If we're clear with our motivation, our attitude, our understanding, our emotion, our action is stronger and more sustainable and more effective. And if we don't pay attention to those underlying factors, we just become confused in our action. We become part of the noise, part of the problem. So it's really, really important for us now to cultivate our best attitude, our best motivation, our best understanding, and our most beautiful emotion. And that's why we're sitting here. That's why we're paying attention to our practice in every word, every thought, and every deed. And if this was important before, and it's always been important, it's even more important now. So I think in these times, our practice has two functions. First, it's a refuge. No one can sustain intense feeling and intense action for a long, long time without taking breaks once in a while. Practice gives us a break, but a real break, a space for reflection and healing, not just a place to space out and be distracted. So our practice centers, our groups, our associations, can be a refuge and should be a refuge for anyone and everyone seeking a place of sanity and kindness and some calm in the storm. But second, practice is much more than a refuge. It's also really bodhisattva training. It's training in compassion. And as we continue to practice, we become stronger and wiser in working for the good. We learn how to offer and receive support. We learn how to love everyone, even our enemies. And maybe most important, we learn how to cultivate a very, very large view, a wide and open view. We come to appreciate how important it is to understand that we don't know what will happen in the future. And, as we've seen, sometimes really negative events can have positive consequences and vice versa. So when things don't go as we would have hoped they would go, we say, okay, I wanted it to be like that. Now it's like this. Let's see what happens now. Let's see what to do. When the Heart Sutra says all dharmas are empty, it's telling us we don't know what will happen. We don't even know what's happening now. And something that isn't anything in the way we usually understand things, something holds up this world so we can always be confident. No matter what happens, good or bad, we can be confident. And we can have hope even in a hopeless situation, because life is literally hope. That's actually what life is. If you don't believe it, observe a child, maybe 1 year old, 2 years old. Observe that child, and that child will teach you life is hope. Life is exactly life because every moment of life has a future moment in it, and that future moment is a moment of potential in which anything can happen. All dharmas are empty, spacious, free, and beyond all our ideas, fears, and explanations. And this is the firm basis on which bodhisattvas act. And this is the view we must offer to the world. And we do it not by preaching about it and getting everybody to agree with our point of view about it. We do it simply by showing up with others and being steady and kind in our ordinary everyday actions all day long, every day with everyone we encounter. So, as usual, the Lojong slogan of the day is very helpful here. It's amazing how that works. slogan 55, examine and analyze. And this is my own commentary to it in Training in Compassion. The best teacher of all is oneself. It's necessary that you become a good and intelligent teacher for yourself, that you have the capacity to talk to yourself reasonably and for the occasion. So when you're tied up in knots and your mind is raging and you are discouraged and troubled, you have the capacity to stop and think about your situation carefully. You can ask yourself, so, is this raging doing me any good? Is this complaining and hollering and bemoaning my fate helping the situation? And am I enjoying myself when I'm doing this? And the answer to all these questions probably is no. And then, having answered the question, you can assess the situation. Okay, here's what's happening. This or that going on inside me, this or that going on outside. So can I change the outside circumstances? Oh, yeah, I can. Just like I was saying a moment ago, Shantideva. Yeah, I can change them, so I'll do it. Maybe it's hard, maybe it takes courage, but I'll do it. I'll stop complaining and I'll figure out what to change and I'll go ahead and change it. And when the answer is no, I cannot change these circumstances, this is just the way it is, then you have to ask, then what can I change? And the answer is, you can change your own heart. You can change your own mind. You can change your attitude. After all, what are you really saying to yourself when you are screaming about your feeling victimized? You're saying to yourself, things are not as they are. Things should be another way, the way I want them to be. That's what you're saying. Or maybe you're saying, yes, things are this way, but I absolutely refuse to accept them. Either way, you're in trouble. It's not going to work. And if you think about it for a few minutes, this will become obvious. But then you might say, well, but I can't change my mind. I keep trying to change my mind, but I'm stuck in this bad emotional state and I can't get out of it. Then you can tell yourself, right, I guess I need some help. I guess I need some support here. So find some support and maintain that support even when you don't need it, so when you need it, it's there. I mean, everybody thinks it's very important to take care of their health, right? They go to the doctor, they take care of their body. Everybody thinks it's really important to take care of their house. When the roof needs to be fixed, they fix it. Everybody thinks they have to have money in the bank, they have to think about, you know, they have enough money to live. So we do that. We pay our bills, we make sure there's enough money in the bank. We're concerned about all this, we pay attention to all this. Why wouldn't we pay just as much attention to our hearts and our minds? Why wouldn't we pay just as much attention to our inner lives and understand that that's just as real and just as important as our bank account, our health, and the condition of our roof? Because if your heart is broken and your mind is in a confusion, your health, your home, and your money will be very small consolation. You'll still be miserable. I know people who have strong bodies, you know, beautiful houses, plenty of money, and they're miserable, absolutely miserable. So it makes a lot of sense, just on a practical level, to support your spiritual friends, your Dharma group, your local church, in exactly the same way that you take out an insurance policy on your house. Who has a house and doesn't take out insurance policy? If you're lucky enough to have a house, you have an insurance policy because you want to protect your house. Ensuring that spiritual support is there for you when you need it, and you're always going to need it, is just as necessary. And more than this, you'll find somewhere to live if your house burns down. If your money drains out of your bank account, you'll get a job, you'll get some more money. But if you lose track of your heart, if your soul dissipates, it's not so easy to get back on track. So you should analyze and examine your situation in that way. That's the 55th slogan. So this is pretty important and basic. Analyze. Examine. You know, Zen has a well-deserved reputation for saying, stop thinking. Don't think. Thinking is no good. Go beyond thinking. Right. And that's really important. We have to be able to appreciate who we are. Appreciate our heart and our mind beyond the level of our thinking. And that's really the main job of Sesshin, to find that ultimate ground of our life, beyond even our life. That all underlying love and sanity that holds up the world. It's absolutely essential that we touch this, not by thinking it's a good idea, but with our whole body and our whole breath, we touch this and are transformed by it. We know it personally and we know it for sure. But also, based on whatever appreciation of this we can have, sometimes we have to think. We have to be able to see what state we're in and to be able to take ourselves in hand. Like I say in the text, be good teachers for ourselves. We have to understand, how is it with me now? How am I doing? What's going on here? What do I need to do now to take care of myself so I can be of some benefit to the people in my life? And this is where teachers and teaching and Sangha are so important, because nobody can be self-reliant. Nobody can do this on their own. Little by little, in order to become good teachers for ourselves, we have to study teachings, reflect on teachings, we have to verify the truth of them, we have to apply them to our living so that we can be a resource for others. And in order to do this, we need teachers, teachings, and Sangha to provide a context and a support and an aid for us in this. In tough times, it's more important than ever that there be stable, wise people, so we don't collectively go crazy in a crazy world. And you have to become that stable, wise person. You have to do that for your own life and for everyone else. So probably you all are familiar with the main practice of the Lojong text, the practice of sending and receiving, Tonglen in Tibetan. And this is a radical practice of using imagination to stretch the heart, in a way, turn it inside out. To be willing to actually receive the suffering of others and to send to those others healing and relief is a radical practice, because it's exactly the opposite of what we want to do. We all want to avoid all suffering, the suffering of others and our own suffering. And we want to receive and take in as much healing and relief as possible. So, like almost everything else in Buddhist practice, Tonglen practice is an upside-down practice, exactly the opposite of what we want and what we've been trained to expect. And compassion, I think people don't really appreciate what compassion is. Compassion is a radical identity shift. It's a radical identity shift. In order to be compassionate, really compassionate, you have to stop thinking of yourself as me over here and all of you over there. No wonder I'm so scared all the time. This little me over here and all of you guys over there. It's a very scary, very threatening situation. This big, scary world, gigantic, scary world, all these people in it, just little old me over here all by myself. No wonder we're all so paranoid. But actually, that's not the way it really is. In the endless, empty space that holds up the world, there isn't any world. and there isn't any me. I am the world. I am others. Others are me. The world is me. There is literally nothing to be afraid of. Nothing to be afraid of, no matter what happens. And when I know that, I can do this practice. I can take in the suffering of all the others. I can risk loving, because that's what it means to love, to be willing to take in the suffering of the others. I can do it, and I can offer healing and love, because I am that big. Is this really true? Yes, it's true in the imagination. Is the world really real? Yes, it's real in the imagination. So let's end our talk today with just a short practice of sending and receiving. Maybe later in the week, if we get around to it, we'll do a longer version. But for now, let's just do a short version to end our talk. Lots of ways of doing the practice. It's very flexible. You can actually do it on one breath. Anytime there's any suffering, either your own suffering or the suffering of another, which is all the time, on one breath, you can practice sending and receiving. So let's start with our body and our breath. We learn in the Mindfulness Sutra that the practice of awareness, of mindfulness, begins with body and breath. And in our practice, body and breath means the empty, spacious nature of reality that we touch into when we return awareness to the body and the breath. As soon as we come back to the body and the breath, we're opening up our heart to this ultimately reliable, ultimately healing and loving reality. So the practice of sending and receiving begins with touching in with this reality for a few breaths. So now imagine yourself sitting across from you. Maybe you've never done this before. It's an interesting thing to do. Imagine yourself as this other person. So see yourself there, sitting. Think of this person's many challenges and sufferings. Think about how close you feel to her or him, and how really ultimately you wish her well. You really would like it if things turned out well for her. And now, based on this feeling, when you breathe in his or her suffering. Imagine that it's flowing out of the body of that person into your body. Take in the suffering. And if you're scared, just notice your fear. Notice your reluctance. You don't have to change it. Just notice it and let it rest in the spaciousness of awareness. And when you exhale, send her or him healing, energy, lightness, ease, delight. Every inhale, receiving suffering. Every exhale, sending love. Now, let's imagine the whole of the suffering world. All the confusion among people and groups of people, all the strife, all the upset, all the dynamic changes taking place on our planet because of the extra carbon in the atmosphere. The melting ice, the rising oceans, the plants, the animals, the sky, somehow evoke the whole of all of this, maybe as a feeling in your body, all of its sadness and disturbance. Notice that this is difficult. Notice that it's scary. Notice that you don't really want to do it. And just let that fear, that dread, be there. Don't try to change it. Let it be there in your spacious, loving awareness. Just feel it. And now when you breathe in the suffering and the turmoil of this whole world. Imagine that it's coming at you from all directions, and let it come into your body. And you can definitely do this. But if it feels scary, or if it feels like way too much, that's fine, that's normal. Just notice the feeling and let it be there. Be willing to be curious about it. Just notice it. And when you breathe out healing and love. With every exhale, heal and love this whole sad, troubled, and beautiful world. And with each exhale, see that you are actually doing that. That it actually is okay. That the world really is okay. You are really bringing healing to the world. Breathing in the suffering, breathing out the healing. Breath after breath, making sure that the breathing in and the breathing out are equalized, one just as long as the other. Breath by breath. And now let's just let that go completely and return to the mind and heart's infinite spaciousness where we began, and just rest there for a few breaths and feel how you are supported. Feel how every breath is full and complete. Feel how right now, in this moment of breathing together, in this present, hopeful moment, everything is complete and at peace. And if you don't feel that way, if you feel some doubt about it or even some really big disturbance, let that be there. That's fine. That's what has to be there now. See how even that feeling is also perfectly held within the space of awareness. Whatever arises now or ever could arise is held in that space of awareness. Even if we don't believe it, even if we don't feel it, it is there. How do we know it's there? Because we know we're alive. And this fact of aliveness cannot be explained, cannot be accounted for, cannot be understood. So thank you very much for practicing this practice together. You can, if you want, every now and then, bring it up in your zazen. You can also completely ignore it if you want, because zazen is this practice in another way. So it doesn't matter if you do this or not. But I think we can all see that it does matter, however we practice, that we do, that we practice. And maybe from now on, until the end of this session, practice with a little bit more seriousness. Because now we understand that we're not just practicing for our own life. Taking care of your own life is taking care of others. Taking care of others is taking care of your own life. So we can't indulge ourselves. We really have a job to do, something that the whole world is depending on us to do. So please, let's be serious and make our best effort starting now more than before. Thank you. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.